We are so pleased to have as our keynote speaker this afternoon someone who can give us a world view of human rights because he comes from the United Nations system. Our guest, Ramu Damodaran, thank you, is the Deputy Director of the Outreach Division of the Office of Public Department of Public Information for the United Nations. And he has kindly taken time out of his very busy schedule. He just came back from China to share with us his thoughts today. I noticed that his earlier assignments with the United Nations involved work with the Departments of Peacekeeping and Special Political Questions, among others. And before that, he was a member of the Indian Foreign Service, India being itself a robust democracy. And his last national position was private secretary to the Prime Minister of India. Prior to joining government service, he worked extensively in Indian mass media. So he must know a thing or two about making impact on public opinion. And please welcome Mr. Damodaran, who will speak on the intriguing title of Private Faces in Public Places.
Thank you so much, Dr. McKechnie. I'm immensely grateful to be here. As I was just telling Dr. Kimberly Riley, I've been in this city for about 14 years, and every few months you discover something new about the city, about an activity of which you had not known before, about a fellowship, about a communion, which you find yourself suddenly privileged to be drawn into and join, and I'm immensely grateful. When I first came here, as you mentioned, from India in 1994, I had a very well-meaning friend in India who told me that the one thing you must prepare for when going to New York is that you're going to a city of impeccably polite people. And you have to be extremely vigilant of that. And one of the things that he advised me to do was whenever I got onto a subway train to introduce myself to all my fellow passengers. I did that for about 10 days, and the results were less dramatic than you may have thought. And the lesson I did draw from that was that, in effect, I think if you take people by surprise, and if you obviously seem benign, I don't think too much harm will come to you. And in a sense, this is really going to be the theme of my conversation with you this afternoon. It's how the United Nations has really now, and I'm so glad that we set the ground by both Dale McKechnie and Sarah McKechnie's references to the United Nations Charter and to the Declaration of Human Rights, how we've shifted, in a sense, from documents which establish the basis upon which to work to that element of benign surprise, to creating an organization which can go to the people of the world and say, we can do this for you. We are in this together. And when I chose as the overall theme of this conversation the title Private Faces in Public Places, I was moved really by two related thoughts. One, of course, was the poem by Auden, where he says, private faces in public places are wiser and nicer than public faces in private places. And the fact that this was a thought that resonated and was quoted very extensively by my country's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru. And the reason I think that that particular thought is apt to our conversation this afternoon, and indeed the larger community to which all of you belong or in a sense have come together under this afternoon, is that the entire dilemma, to my mind, of our world today, and certainly the United Nations, is that reconciliation, of that distinction between the public and the private. In the sense, and you can extend that definition of privacy to whatever nature you want. You talked, Sarah, if I may, of the Soviet definition of groups rather than individuals in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that was because a totalitarian state like the Soviet Union at that point wanted to safeguard the privacy of the individual from international scrutiny, not because of any benign or altruistic interest, but because it felt it would be intrusive. So it did not want that public face in that private place. You have countries in the world today where acts of war, of desperation, of terror against populations within national borders are committed by governments in control. There is no privacy there. There is no difference between the public space and the private space. There is, in effect, a degree of mass annihilation and murder. So if you consider that, where are we now to look at ourselves in the year 2008, really at the bridge of a time? And I was very moved by an earlier talk of Dale McKechnie, where he said that when you think about this, these are issues or problems that go beyond the neurons of the mind. Because if you are looking for a new kingdom, it's not a new kingdom that you need to attain. The new kingdom, however you define it, however you choose to call it, is already here. All that you have to do is to walk towards it. It's evocative, I think, of what one of the great old sages of my country, an Islamic sage, Hafiz, once said, that the sun never looks to the earth and says, "You owe me." And if we were to allow our own love to be like that, we could light up the sky. And we could allow that purely private sentiment that we possess to become public and to illuminate the public space. There is a certain degree of, let's face it, there's a certain degree of discomfort sometimes in talking about intrinsically personal elements like faith and religion and trust, particularly when you're talking about a largely political organization like the United Nations, an organization of many national sensitivities and sensibilities. But there is also, I think, a realization that no matter what motivation brings you to the road itself is the same. And so when Dale remarked a little while ago about the creation of the universe as a result, if I remember, of sustained and direct thought, I think it's something that many of us believe in. We do believe in a higher being who has given us form, who has given our planet form, who has given us the power and the possibility to give our own futures form. On the other hand, there may be a school which says that this entire universe to which we belong and our existence itself is completely independent of any such entity or being and is purely a result of natural or so-called cosmic forces. Whichever way you look at it, I would like us to focus again on the road. And I think it's illuminating in that sense to think of a roadmap that about 30 years ago the American scientist Carl Sagan once drew, when he said, if you picture the history of the universe within the space of a calendar year, and you picture the beginning of the universe, what some would call the Big Bang, as having happened on the 1st of January that year, you will find that condensing these 15 million years of the universe's existence into those 365 days, you will find that on May the 31st, the Milky Way came to being. And then suddenly you have this long spread of total non-history, if you will, till suddenly, on Christmas Eve, dinosaurs first appear. And then, on December the 28th, the first flower blooms. By that particular point in time, man and woman have come into being at 10:30 p.m. on December the 31st of that year, an hour and a half before midnight. As we approach midnight, at 11:59 and 20 seconds, agriculture comes to our planet. At 11:59 and 40 seconds, the European Renaissance begins. And so the time that we are now in, the year 2008, we are now in the last 5 seconds of that year that Carl Sagan drew before us of the 15 million years. And the option before us is quite clear. Are we going to use these last 5 seconds in order to work towards the final termination, if you will, of our universe, or to the closing of an exciting chapter, a dramatic year, a tumultuous year, as we now, empowered by all that we have learned and discovered in that year, move on to the beginning of a new year? That, to my mind, is the question before us. Kimberly and I were talking a little while ago about her specialization in research, which is the theater of the Weimar Republic in Germany. And I was reminded of a quotation of Bertolt Brecht, where he said, "The one thing you should not be afraid of is death. What you should be afraid of is having led an inadequate life." And I think in the context of that one calendar year that I was trying to describe to you, that is really the sense of mission that the United Nations now must employ, empowered by citizens like you, like I, and the governments whom we have brought into being. Because that will make all the difference in these last 5 seconds and make sure that we become, in a sense, the progenitor of a new year, a new generation, a new possibility, and indeed, if I may borrow your phrase, a new kingdom. How do we go about this? As I said, I regard this really as a conversation. I wanted to share some thoughts with you, and with your indulgence here, I would very much like to extend that conversation to one between us, and I would like to learn from you what you think are your thoughts. I think sometimes working in the United Nations, we find it very helpful to work with acronyms, and I'm sure you've all heard of the various UN agencies and programs which have these titles, which some of them can be said quite easily, like UNESCO and so on, and others are very difficult to say because there's a whole series of consonants. And I mean, the whole process began about 40 years ago when we had the first UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, which within 2 years ago the letters were spelled out to say, "Under no circumstances take a decision." But be that as may, we've been rather comfortable with acronyms at the United Nations. And with your permission, I would like to elaborate upon this theme of private faces in public faces by really using GOODWILL as an acronym to anchor our conversation and our thoughts. And if we break it down, I would really point to 8 elements which would make up that acronym of GOODWILL. Globalization, openness, opportunity, daring, wisdom, intuition, leadership, and living. Each of these, in a sense, flows from the other. And I will not elaborate too much upon each of these because I think that you will find in your own context that the resonance or the relevance is immediately clear. As far as globalization is concerned, it's something which all of us are living with, are familiar with, and it's surprisingly enough not something which is very new or radical, because even I think in this country, far even when it was at a particularly insular phase, both politically and, I dare say, socially, in the early 60s, it was a time when Martin Luther King said quite clearly that the heritage of every nation and of every people is a cumulative effect of all the thoughts and ideas and creations of women and men living and dead from all over the world. So you have that totality of the human experience coming into your particular sphere. Today, that degree of globalization has extended to what someone called really the 3 C's of commerce, of control, of curiosity. But nonetheless, we realize, and this is where the public spaces come in, we realize that there is really no more private space in terms of global perils or global issues. There is, simply put, no place to hide. And even societies in the world which have fortified their self-defenses by banning communications with the outside world, by insulating their borders, by being completely withdrawn into themselves, have had gradually to open up. And I think I say this in all candor, as and in all pride, not as